Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the release of an incriminating email chain between Donald Trump Jr. and a British tabloid journalist representing a Russian pop singer whose father is a billionaire developer close to Putin. The emails are about setting up a June 2016 meeting in Trump Tower with a Russian lawyer based on the promise that this lawyer worked for the Russian government and had top secret information from the Russian Crown Prosecutor that was damaging to Hillary Clinton and, quote, is part of Russia and its government's support for Mr. Trump. Asha Rangappa, Associate Dean at Yale Law School, who is a former FBI special agent specializing in counterintelligence investigations in New York City, joins us to discuss the extent to which the participants in this meeting acted with corrupt intent to violate campaign finance laws, and if they were innocent, why did they not call the FBI immediately to report an effort on the part of Russian intelligence to compromise them? Then we'll examine the incriminating emails further with David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report, who was previously a special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and is a counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. He joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, Trump Jr.'s Smoking Gun Email, and the sleazy cast of characters emerging in this sordid tale that reflects the nature of the Trump presidency and the Trump family business that is built on financial ties with the international dregs of bottom feeders, tacky celebrities, kleptocrats, gangsters, and oligarchs. Then finally, we will speak with Danielle Ivory, a reporter with the New York Times who covers the intersection of business and government, including contracts and regulations, about her article co-written with Robert Federici, a reporter at ProPublica, The Deep Industry Ties of Trump's Deregulation Teams. We'll look into how these appointees to Trump's deregulation teams have been working in secret across the government, with 28 of the 71 appointees identified so far having close ties to industry with clear conflicts of interest. And joining us now is Asha Rangappa, who is the Associate Dean at Yale Law School, who teaches national security law and related courses at Wesleyan University, the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University, and the University of New Haven. Previously, she served as a special agent at the Federal Bureau of Investigations, specializing in counterintelligence investigations in New York City. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asha Rangappa.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Asha, what do you make of this email chain that clearly the New York Times got hold of and then now Donald Trump Jr. himself has released the email chain, which, frankly, to my mind, is pretty damning. I mean, it looks to my mind that you could charge Donald Trump Jr. with acting with corrupt intent to violate the campaign finance laws. And unless Jared Kushner, the son-in-law, and Paul Manafort, the campaign director, were completely in the dark about the purpose of the meeting, they could also be charged with corrupt intent. Or at the very least, I would think that they should have contacted the FBI immediately, realizing that this was a sort of Russian intelligence fishing expedition.
Yeah, so you pointed out a lot of different angles their problematic yeah. angles with this meeting. So, yes, I think the content of the emails that Donald Trump Jr. tweeted out today and then were reported by the Times definitely eliminate any plausible deniability that he has, that he didn't know that this meeting was being arranged with someone who was essentially officially representing the Russian government. And to that end, it definitely puts his knowledge and intent squarely on the table in terms of what he knew he was getting into, and that definitely implicates him in various election fraud statutes. The intelligence side is a little bit, he should have called the FBI regardless, but the intelligence side is a little bit harder of a case to make that he necessarily knew it was an intelligence operation. I mean, most people don't understand intelligence tradecraft and wouldn't know this is a dangle to see how I'm going to react to the government potentially approaching me with information. But obviously, there were red flags when he was told that the Russians were very interested in his father as a candidate, that they had damaging information, that they were sending someone to represent them to give that information. So all of these things, even if he didn't know that it was an intelligence operation or related to one, should have prompted him to call the FBI for sure.
Well, in an email on June the 7th, 2016, this intermediary between the pop singer and the Russian or Azerbaijanian pop singer Emin and Rob Golser and his agent, who apparently had met Donald Trump earlier and he had worked with them on setting up the 2013 Miss Universe contest in Moscow. So this Rob Goldstone is this British tabloid journalist who, frankly, you couldn't find a better... If you wanted to go to Central Casting to find a sleazy yellow press tabloid journalist, you couldn't do better with this character. But I guess I'm assassinating his character as we speak. But nevertheless, he wrote to Donald Jr. on June the 7th, 2016, saying, "Hope all is well. Emin, this is the Azerbaijanian pop singer whose father is a huge real estate developer in Moscow who's close to Putin. Emin asked that I schedule a meeting with you and the Russian government attorney who is flying over from Moscow for this Thursday. I believe you're aware of the meeting, so wondered if 3 p.m. or later on Thursday works for you. I assume it will be at your office. Best, Rob Goldstone." So there's no way in the world that, this is a Russian government attorney. And, of course, everybody's been saying, no, she's not. But I talked yesterday to Bill Browder, who was the biggest investor in Russia until he was kicked out. And his lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, was murdered in Russian prison. And this lawyer was the one that was the leading Kremlin attack dog against him. And then she came over here to defend the Russian criminals who'd laundered the $230 million they'd stolen of the taxes that Bill Browder had paid to the Russian government, and that, which they laundered into Manhattan real estate, and she defended them. So what was she? A Russian government lawyer, do you think?
I mean, I just don't know enough about her background. What's important for purposes of what the U.S., you know, what Bob Mueller will look at and what the U.S. intelligence community cares about is that it was presented to Donald Trump Jr. that she was a government attorney working for the Russians. I don't know if the work that she did on the Magnitsky Act actually, you know, she was doing on behalf of the Russian government. But as far as Donald Trump Jr. knew, she was coming to as some sort of representative or agent of the Russian government. And to that end, that really speaks to what his knowledge and intent was in going to the meeting.
Well, there had been a lot of reports saying that the FBI, she was on the FBI's watch list, that she was considered, I don't know whether you call her an intelligence agent, but she was certainly somebody that the FBI had, you know, had flagged.
Well, yes, and in that case, this meeting would be of a special interest to them.
And again, I'm speaking with Ashat Rangappa, who's an associate dean at Yale Law School, who teaches national security law and related courses at Wesleyan University, the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University, and the University of New Haven. Previously, she served as a special agent at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, specializing in counterintelligence investigations in New York City. So, Ashat, we don't know how the New York Times got hold of this email chain, but clearly it's forced Donald Trump Jr. to release it, and of course the president himself tweeted out praise for his son for being so upstanding and so transparent. But what's your overall interpretation of how much this email chain, you know, sort of digs the hole deeper? And certainly it's brought back the Russian story. If Donald Trump wanted to get that off the headlines, it's come back to haunt him.
Yeah, the Russian story I don't think was ever going anywhere, but this has definitely made it front and center for a while now. I would disagree with you, Ian, that the New York Times story forced Donald Trump Jr. to release those emails. It's not clear to me why he did that. I don't know if at the time that he did that he had a lawyer representing him, because I'm not really sure that even if the New York Times was about to report it, that it was in his interest. I mean, he just shouldn't have tweeted those things out, period. He shouldn't be tweeting, period. I mean, this is appears to run in the family. You know, he needs to stop talking. He needs to stop tweeting. He needs to stop giving details about what, you know, happened at the meeting, because he's going to end up contradicting himself. So, you know, I think that at this point, his best bet would just be to do what Jared Kushner appears to be doing, which is just to stay off the radar. You know, I think he's also, Donald Trump Jr., happily offered to testify under oath to the Senate. Again, not a good idea if you're his defense attorney. So I think that he's definitely placed him, I mean, he's going to be under scrutiny. And, you know, is this email chain on its own enough to convict him of something? Probably not. It's definitely enough to suggest that there might have been a criminal violation of the election fraud statute. So I'm sure that Mueller will investigate that. And I think it definitely adds credence to the people who've been doubting, because we just haven't seen a lot of public information on the intelligence side of it, that the Russians were actively targeting and trying to recruit individuals to assist them in their operation to influence the election.
Well, it's my understanding, though, is that the New York Times notified Donald Jr. that they possessed his email chain from June of 2016.
They did. My understanding is that, too, that they reached out to him for comment. And my only point is, I don't think that that necessarily compelled him to release the emails. I don't see what the advantage was to him to doing that, except to perhaps look as though he was being on the up and up or something. But
well,
yeah.
his father, the president of the United States, said, "My son is a high quality person, and I applaud his transparency." But let's then turn to, you mentioned the intelligence tradecraft term of a dangle. So
Yes. Describe
to our audience how a dangle works. And you know, I used to work on arms control in the former Soviet Union, and they just try to recruit you all the time. It's habitual. I mean, I don't know whether it's the same under Russia as it was under the Soviets. Probably not as quite as zealous. But it was a routine that you would always be approached by somebody that was trying to recruit you to be either an asset or, as they say, a useful idiot.
Right. You know, so a dangle is exactly what it sounds like. It's putting a potential source or something that you might want in front of you and say, if you'll bite. So, you know, the Russians might dangle in front of U.S. intelligence someone who claims to have, you know, inside information on, you know, the Russian government. And, you know, if the FBI would take that, then, you know, they could start giving this information. So, you know, you're always very skeptical of these kinds of things. In fact, Robert Hansen, who's one of our worst spies in American history, walked into the Russian embassy three times offering to spy for them, and they thought he was a dangle and didn't believe him, and so turned him away. So, you know, in intelligence circles, these things are often spotted and viewed with skepticism. But what the Russians would have been doing in this kind of situation is, you know, targeting people close to the campaign, which, you know, gives them access, and then assessing them to see what their vulnerabilities might be. So by putting something out like this, by saying, hey, we have damaging information, it's possessed by the Russian government, do you want it? They start to get a sense of how this person is going to react. Is the person enthusiastic? Are they suspicious? Do they call the FBI? Do they put them off? You know, they get a lot of information about the character and willingness and how easy it is going to be to recruit someone simply based on how they react to this kind of offer. And so Donald Trump Jr.'s reaction gave them a lot of information. These are people who are completely willing to potentially, you know, violate the law to help their father, Donald Trump, win. And that's something that they could use in future, you know, offers or opportunities, because they can simply exploit that desire to help Trump win, that shared desire apparently, in order to get these people on board.
Well, the first approach, of course, from Rob Goldstone is pretty damning in the sense that what they are offering. Good morning, Emin, again, the Azerbaijanian pop star, just called to ask me to contact you with something very interesting. The Crown Prosecutor of Russia met with his father, Aris, this morning, and in their meeting offered to provide the Trump campaign with some official documents and information that would incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia and would be very useful to your father. This is obviously very high-level and sensitive information, but is part of Russia and its government's support for Mr. Trump, helped along by Aris, the father, the big developer, and Emin. What do you think is the best way to handle this information? Would we be able to speak to Emin about it directly? And I can also send this info to your father via Rona, who I don't know who that is, but it is ultra sensitive, so wanted to send it to you first. So, you know, maybe Goldstone is trying to make it all very sort of tantalizing, but on the surface, that sounds like, I don't know. What does it sound to you? You dealt with traitors. I was going to use the word treason, but I that word has to be used advisedly. How would you characterize this dangle here?
So which part? The actual approach?
Yeah, just in general, what they're offering up seems coming from the very sort of heart of the Russian government. Right, if the Crown Prosecutor of Russia is
right.
Anybody.
I mean, what they're offering is very valuable information, but also tied to some red flags that this is from the Russian government. This is coming from, you know, you've been meeting with a government attorney. The Russian government is very interested in having your father win. So they've tied something that is incredibly desirable with certain things that for many reasonable people would cause them to say no, or not respond, or call the police. And so, again, they are able to gauge many things about what makes Donald Trump Jr. tick simply by how he responds to that particular offer, even with those red flags attached to it.
Well, just in closing, Asha, my understanding is that the FBI do a lot of stings in counterintelligence and counterterrorism, etc. And they've nailed a bunch of would-be terrorists. Maybe some of them have been pretty stupid, but they nevertheless have nailed them for planning terrorist attacks. So where's the threshold of the law, and what's the difference here between an FBI sting where you invite people to do something illegal and they take the bait? How would you compare that to this situation we're talking about with Donald Trump Jr.?
The difference is that this is a foreign government. So when the government does a criminal sting operation, they can, you know, create a certain situation. They can't actually prod someone to engage in the criminal activity. That's entrapment. You know, they have to let the person kind of make their choice and go down the path on their own. That's a criminal thing. I mean, I don't even see that there's really any meaningful comparison to this. This is a foreign intelligence, a foreign government potentially using their intelligence service to recruit an American citizen to basically violate the integrity of our elections, period. So I don't think that there's really any comparison to be made with, you know, law enforcement sting operations there.
Well, what you've told us is bad enough, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Okay, no problem. Thank you, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Asha Rangappa, who is Associate Dean at Yale Law School, who teaches national security law and related courses at Wesleyan University, the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University, and the University of New Haven. And previously, she served as a special agent at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, specializing in counterintelligence investigations in New York City. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back examining further the incriminating emails that Donald Trump Jr. was forced to release.
That you want me to do? Yes, you have, girl. Don't you know you gotta tell the truth, yeah? Baby, why don't you tell me the truth now? You know you got me going. You can't hide your lying eyes and your smile.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now, David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously a White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. His latest article at the Huffington Post is Trump Jr.'s Smoking Gun Email. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halperin.
Thanks, Ian.
And the email chain, of course, that was released by Donald Trump. He was notified that the New York Times possessed it. And Donald Trump, his father, is celebrating the release of this email chain, applauding his son as a, my son is a high-quality person and I applaud his transparency. But why do you think he's releasing it? Because it, as your article points out, I'd say this is a red-hot smoking gun.
Well, he's releasing it because the New York Times apparently was about to release it. I guess he decided that it was better just to get it out than to have it look like he was hiding. But look, here was the, he was the guy who yelled on TV last June, we have no connection to Russia, and this story is ridiculous. And that was 3 weeks after he had had a meeting with the Russians, 15 days after he'd had a meeting with the Russians, where they where he went there because they promised information to help swing the election to his dad. So he's got a lot to hide, and he's continued to hide things until absolutely there was no question it was going to come out anyway.
Well, you know, some of this stuff you can't make up, and if you were casting a movie, you couldn't find a more of a caricature of a sleazy tabloid journalist than this Rob Goldstone character.
Or a douchey son of a president than Donald Trump Jr.
Right, exactly. So, but it's pretty clear from the email chain that they knew that they were meeting with this woman who is, in fact, characterized by Goldstone in setting up the meeting as a Russian government attorney.
And yeah.
So, you know, I talked to yesterday to Bill Browder, whose attorney, Magnitsky, was murdered. And this woman,
right,
of course, was the main Kremlin flunky out there discrediting Magnitsky, putting a target on his back.
And trying to get rid of the sanctions imposed by the 2012 Magnitsky Act.
Right. And yet they met with it. I mean, just on the level of sleaze, you wouldn't meet with somebody like this, you know, unless you either had no taste or somehow were complicitous in whatever it is that she was about to offer. But the point is that she was characterized as the Russian government attorney.
Yes. I mean, there's no way this looks good. If she was there to press him on getting rid of the sanctions, he described just talking about adoption, but it was the U.S. that wanted to be able to adopt Russian children. What the Russians wanted, what Putin wanted, was to get rid of the sanctions. So if that's actually what she wanted, they shouldn't have been having that meeting. And even today, you've got the Trump administration actively lobbying on the Hill to try to restrain legislation that would increase sanctions or tighten the sanctions regime on Russia. So if that was it, it seems improper. And certainly it was what was actually pitched to him, dirt on Hillary Clinton from the Russian government, that is, violates the election laws, taking something of value from a foreign government, and it is a conspiracy to collude with Russia to influence the election. So it's all out there. All our fantasies of how corrupt and crooked the whole Trump campaign is now is all right in front of us. And the question is, what is our country going to do about it? We know this president is crooked and corrupt, and the administration is frankly and openly kleptocratic about profiting from the presidency. What are we going to do? What are the members of Congress going to do, the Republicans that have been giving Trump legitimacy because he's been giving them the hardline pro-corporate, pro-rich person agenda that they've always dreamed of?
Well, it's the Koch brothers' agenda, isn't it?
Maybe. Yes, it is. It really is. As much as Trump attacked the Koch brothers, and it's the Grover Norquist agenda. Three things that they want, and I think I said it on your show before. They want tax cuts for the rich, their rich donors. They want deregulation, meaning no environmental regulation, no education regulation, no labor, no health regulation for their rich donors. and they want a Supreme Court justice like Neil Gorsuch, who proved by the end of the term that he was the most pro-rich donor and most hard-right conservative on the court. So it's their dream person. He's giving them the dream of Koch brothers, right-wing, anti-populist agenda, and they're letting him be king of the United States. And, you know, frankly, just as offensive to me as an American as the Don Jr. collusion with Russia scandal was the simple gesture of having Ivanka sit in Donald's chair when Donald got up to do whatever it was he got up to do. When there were plenty of qualified U.S. officials, senior U.S. officials available, Ivanka sat in his chair. The idea was, these are the people who own the country, they're the oligarchs, she's the princess, Princess Ivanka, and she will sit in the chair when the king gets up to go to the bathroom. And I just think we are losing control of this country unless we stand up fast and demand accountability and that the Mueller investigation move forward and we get rid of this president.
And, of course, this Russian issue has already driven Trump into the hands of the Congress. We essentially don't even have a separation of powers anymore because he needs them to prevent an impeachment, which, is, of course, as more and more stuff comes out, certainly appears to be becoming more and more likely. And again, I'm speaking with David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. And his latest article at the Huffington Post is Trump Jr. Smoking Gun Email. But let's talk about, I mentioned the sleazy British tabloid guy.
Yep.
Rob Goldstone. But he's working. His client is this Azerbaijani pop singer, Emin Agalarov, right, whose father is a big developed this big shopping center, luxury center in Moscow, and he was given a big award by Putin.
Yes.
And I believe Emin was married to the daughter of the head of Aliyev, wasn't he? The kleptocratic family that had been running Azerbaijan throughout the Soviet period?
That's new. That fact is new to me. I knew that the father was sometimes known as the Donald Trump of Russia, and I knew that he was tight with Putin and got an award from Putin. But that does not surprise me at all. I mean, the connections between the Trump family and Putin and all the other oligarchs and people of the corrupt former Soviet Union countries is, you know, they're very like-minded people.
Right. I believe that the wife has divorced him.
Well, the music is awful, so I'm not surprised.
Yeah, but Donald Trump appears in his pop video. That's the extraordinary thing is that on Emin's 35th birthday, Trump shot a special video in which he declared, "You're a winner."
Oh, yeah. I thought you meant he sang and danced in the video.
No,
I saw that.
You're a winner, you're a champ, you're great at real estate, and boy, can you entertain. And of course, a part of the guy's video for one of his songs was Trump makes this appearance and says, because he's pretending to be asleep in a board with a boardroom meeting, and Trump appears and says, "You're fired." And we're all supposed to laugh at that, I presume. But at any rate, this is like sleaze scratching the back of sleaze here. It's so unbelievable. And apparently, this is what I understand, is that a lot of money came out of Azerbaijan in all these various developments. Some of which the Russians may have filmed some of the transactions, and maybe they've used them to hold over Trump. But isn't there also some other blackmail material out there? There's a video of Trump choking Melania in a hotel elevator in a fit of rage. Do you know anything about that?
No, not that I've seen confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
But these stories are definitely floating around.
Mm-hmm. These are separate.
But what I do know, here's the fact that I do know, Ian. Right. Even if there's no collusion with Russia, which there is now, but even if you couldn't prove it about Donald Trump obstructed justice. It's a straightforward proposition. He told Comey that he hoped he would go easy on his friend Mike Flynn, who's a good guy, not because Mike Flynn was innocent or because the national interest would be served, but because he was a good guy, not a valid reason for Comey to go easy on Mike Flynn. And then when Comey did not do that, he fired him. That's obstruction of justice. And Comey, and then Trump admitted Russia was on his mind when he fired Comey. Trump should be impeached for that. Straight, you know, period, full stop. That was an impeachable offense. And to me, the idea that more members of Congress aren't saying that now is a scandal in itself.
But do you think that the reason that Ryan and McConnell, who are enacting the Koch brothers' agenda, which everything that's been passed by this administration so far has almost entirely been the Koch brothers' agenda, they really don't need him anymore, and he's completely neutralized because he desperately needs the House to prevent an impeachment. And it seems like, would you agree that we don't seem to have a separation of power? He doesn't do anything. He just goes along with whatever they do, which is not the role of the president, right?
We don't have a functioning government.
That's
what we have is nothing going on in Congress, but where the government is functioning and functioning in a malevolent way is at the agency level, where the people appointed by Trump to run the EPA and the Department of Education, where I testified yesterday, and the Department of the Interior and all these other places are getting rid of all the common sense rules to protect us from global warming and from predatory abuses by banks and for-profit education and other things. So that is where the action is, and in the Supreme Court, particularly if there's another appointment. And that is where government is functioning. It's not really legitimate or acting in a reasonable way, but that's where Trump can get things done, and that's where he'll continue to get things done. And frankly, even if he's impeached, those same kinds of people will be doing it for Mike Pence.
Well, that's the thing that you always come back to, isn't it? That what we really should be focusing on is who's the next president, whether it's Mike Pence or somebody else. But it looks like, you know, now that Mike Pence has hired, he hired lawyers, as of Donald Trump Jr. has hired lawyers, but Pence has been doing fundraising. So it's almost like he's on the back burner, but they're turning the back burner up a little bit.
Well, I think he's playing the game that he wants to play to be president, I guess. It wouldn't necessarily involve taking on Trump now, but he issued like the blandest statement ever issued by a vice president in the face of something like this. Yeah, I can't remember what it was, but it was something like just now, like Donald Trump is president. There's no doubt about that. Let me see if I can dig it up here. But whatever it was, he's starting to distance himself from Trump, but he's not going to do it aggressively. But he can sit back and enjoy this. But the only reason he's president, I believe, here's the statement from the spokesman for Pence. Pence is not focused on stories about the campaign, particularly stories about the time before he joined the ticket. Boy, that is separating himself, I would say.
Right.
But, Pence would be the most right-wing president in history, but in terms of the personally more than Trump, but in terms of the policies, I think he'd be happy to inherit, you know, people like Scott Pruitt and people who are all about the corruption of Washington, of corporations just buying Washington. He may add, Pence will add a more of a religious intolerance flavor to it, potentially, to make it a little bit worse. But for me, and I'm sure for a lot of your listeners and a lot of people out there, It is the offensive and alarming idea that a gangster, a personally corrupt, crooked, kleptocratic man sits in the Oval Office now is so destructive of our values and our peace of mind, frankly, that we'd rather have, a guy who is right-wing as anything, but it seems like otherwise, you know, the nicest guy you'd ever want to meet and not personally crooked sitting in that chair.
Unless you're a woman.
But Trump is more than Trump. I agree with that, but no,
but
no one abuses them more either.
No, but The Handmaid's Tale, you know, he's the Duval character in that, Mike Pence. But so would you characterize then this 2.25-hour meeting at G20 with Putin and Trump, at which there was no national security advisor, he was kicked out? I don't know how long these guys can pretend, put up with it. The so-called adults in the room, General Mattis and McMaster, they seem to have no influence whatsoever. And my sense was that it was kind of a gangster summit.
Yeah, it was a summit where it was reaffirmed that our country, America under Trump, is like an outlaw nation. Mm-hmm. And Madison McMaster, you know, they probably tell themselves that they're helping the country by having adults involved. But then, you know, McMaster, you know, slavishly praises Trump more than he would ever need to. You know, and they, what he actually said with a straight face to reporters when they asked him what Trump's going to talk about with Putin, he said, well, there's no set agenda, whatever the president wants to talk about. I have not heard a more terrifying sentence this year. And of course, the thing turned out to be a disaster. They discussed building a mutual contraption to fight against cybercrime and perhaps cyberbullying also.
Right. which Mnuchin went out and sold, and then the next day
Trump said, okay, that was
Trump
done.
Pulled it.
Yeah. Well, Mnuchin is his boy. He's like almost like like another Trump son, really.
Yeah, oh, they're all so disgusting. Well, David Halperin, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Halperin, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously a White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. And his latest article at the Huffington Post is Trump Jr.'s Smoking Gun Email. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the deep industry ties of Trump's deregulation teams. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Danielle Ivory, a reporter at the New York Times who covers the intersection of business and government, including contracts and regulations. And she is the co-author with Robert Federici, a reporter at ProPublica, who covers campaign finance. They are the co-authors of a new report at the New York Times and ProPublica, The Deep Industry Ties of Trump's Deregulation Teams. Welcome to Background Briefing, Danielle Ivory.
Thanks for having me.
And this is a very important article because this is a sort of stealth attack that's going on under the radar, it would seem, but it has enormous implications for American citizens in terms of their health and the protections they expect, environmental protections in particular. And you've identified about 71 appointees, including 28 with potential conflicts of interest in this group that's been set up by President Trump, who signed an executive order back in February requiring federal agencies to form these deregulatory teams. So let's start with the teams. I mean, this, I must say, this all sounds like the ruminations of Stephen Bannon, the White House strategist, who was vowed to deconstruct the regulatory state. So is that the genesis?
Well, I don't know if the genesis of the task force was Steve Bannon. We just know that President Trump signed an executive order in February ordering the creation of these teams across the government. So every major federal agency has one of these teams. And so we've been trying to just figure out who's on those teams and what their backgrounds are. And some agencies have been forthcoming about who is on these task forces. Others have been very, very secretive. Some refuse to tell us any at all. But we filed FOIAs at all of them, and we're hoping that one day we'll get correspondence and calendars and, in some cases, the names of the actual people on the teams. But we think it's important because, you know, we've already found from, as you said, we've identified 71 appointees and 28 of them have what we think are potential conflicts. And some of these appointees are reviewing rules that their previous employers sought to weaken or kill or roll back. And at least two of them are positioned to, you know, possibly profit if certain regulations are undone. So we think it's important to know who's on these teams and who might be looking at what regulations could be eliminated or rolled back.
And FOIA, of course, being the Freedom of Information Act, but to start out with the Education Department, where you've identified two members of the deregulation teams, one of whom comes from a for-profit college operator, and obviously they're trying to get the gainful employment rule killed, which Obama put in. And also there's a suggestion here that there's also the other employee, of course, with a pro-charter advocacy group. So the writing's pretty clearly on the wall there, isn't it? I mean, this is somewhat like putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank.
Well, you know, all we can say is that we know what their professional backgrounds are and what regulations their employers, or in some cases clients, that they've represented have targeted in the past. So we, you know, we can't say for sure that someone who worked at a pro-charter organization in the past would necessarily be targeting pro-charter regulations or anti-charter or would be targeting regulations because of that. But we do think it's good to know where these people are coming from so that, you know, when we actually see regulations being rolled back, we can, you know, follow those trails.
And the fact, though, that some of these people, these appointees, they're lawyers who represented businesses, some are staff members of political dark money groups. So tell me about that, because that's clearly been a massive vehicle that has taken place since Citizens United decision from the Supreme Court.
Right. Well, so we looked at, for example, Samantha Dravis, who is the chairwoman of the deregulation team at the EPA. She was the president of the Rule of Law Defense Fund, which brought together energy companies and Republican attorneys general to file lawsuits against the federal government over environmental regulations during the Obama era. And, you know, that group has been criticized as being a vehicle for corporate donors to gain the credibility and sort of backing of state attorneys general in, you know, battling for regulations to be rolled back or not to be put in place at all. Donors to that group, we know from my colleague Eric Lipton's very brilliant reporting in the past, have included the American Petroleum Institute, ConocoPhillips, the energy company, and coal companies. So, you know, we know where she's coming from, and we also know that she's been meeting with industry people.
Well, but the Republican Attorney General Association has also, as your article points out, received funding from the Freedom Partners, which is the Charles and David Koch group that are somewhat ubiquitous in terms of their influence, it seems, over this
Congress. That's right.
So, again, I'm speaking with Danielle Ivory, who's a reporter at The New York Times who covers the intersection of business and government, including contracts and regulation. She, along with Robert Badarecci, a reporter with ProPublica, who also covers campaign finance, are the co-authors of a new report at The New York Times and ProPublica, The Deep Industry Ties of Trump's Deregulation Teams. So, at the end of the day, once these teams, you've, you know, for the first time your article's exposed at least who some of these people are. None of this has been made public from the outset, has it?
Oh, that's right. There were some agencies, actually, who have announced who's on the task forces. EPA actually very early on put out the names of all of its task force members publicly and has actually held public hearings as well, which is not to say that EPA has been thoroughly transparent either. We've asked for every task force member's correspondence and calendars, and we've asked a lot of questions, and we have yet to get correspondence or calendars through our Freedom of Information Act request, and a lot of questions went unanswered. But yeah, a lot of the other people that we found were through digging, through public records requests, through public records that just happened to be online, and also we went through the press offices at every one of these agencies.
Well, it does seem, you know, I sort of mentioned the idea of Dracula in charge of the blood bank, or the fox in charge of the chicken house. Those kind of metaphors, in the extent to which it does seem pretty clear that a lot of these people have come from industry groups with a specific agenda. For example, the Agriculture Department. You've identified Rebecca Adcock, who previously lobbied as a top executive at CropLife America, which is apparently a trade association for pesticide makers. So that would indicate, what could one assume from that in terms of rules and regulations about consumer health from the use of pesticides?
Well, so Rebecca Adcock is one of a few appointees that we found that had been previously registered to lobby the agency that they're currently working at. You know, in that case, the Agriculture Department deals with issues involving farmers, including crop insurance and land conservation rules. It also deals with pesticide companies. I think it may be a little too early to tell what exactly will be the outcome of Rebecca Adcock being on the deregulation team at the Agriculture Department, but I think it's something that we should keep an eye on because she certainly came from a professional background that in the past indicated that she had a slant on many issues that affect the USDA.
But isn't this all in the sort of rubric of you have to for every new regulation you have to kill two or something? What was the original sort of marching orders that the Trump administration gave to these deregulators?
Well, that was actually another executive order. Mr. Trump signed an executive order that, this is a little bit of an oversimplification, but basically said that for every regulation that is approved, two should be cut. It's not quite as simple as that. It's not that, like, you actually cut two regulations. It's more about the economic impact of those regulations and trying to zero that out. So that was a different executive order, but of course the message to the agencies has been very clear that regulations are a burden on business and should be limited. And that message, though it's come in the form of a couple of many executive orders from the Trump administration, that sentiment that regulation should be streamlined or cut back is not a new one. I mean, we saw that during the Obama administration, both Bush administrations, the Clinton administration. There have been several attempts in the past to cut so-called red tape. But what seems to be different about this attempt that we were looking at is that the Trump administration has really empowered agencies to select political appointees to make these sort of decisions. And in some cases, full teams are comprised of political appointees. Some are comprised only of career staff. So that seems to be a difference. It also seems very secretive, and that may be different from the past. And it also seems like there's an emphasis on eliminating entire regulations during this effort to deregulate.
But what do you think is the sort of psychological or justification, or what is driving? I mean, going back to Stephen Bannon's idea, since he's the chief strategist of this administration, the idea of dismantling the regulatory state. What is the assumption here that you mentioned the word red tape, which is a sort of euphemism, I guess, for trying to understand the mentality of people who apparently believe that most regulations are somehow the whims of bureaucrats, that they're not somehow anchored in reason for having them in the first place. I would have thought you would have, for example, one of the things I'd heard that they were working on is deregulating the FDA, and excuse me. My understanding is that 9 out of 10 drugs that the drug companies put forth to be tested by the FDA are essentially worthless. They have to pass two; they have to be effective, most of them aren't. 9 out of 10. And that's just the way it's been. So in other words, the drug companies put forth all kinds of new drugs, and the FDA, in the interest of public health and the American people, test these drugs, and they find out that 9 out of 10 of them don't work. Apparently, what they want to do now is get rid of the FDA's responsibility for testing drugs and basically allow the drug companies themselves to test whether these drugs are safe and effective are the two guidelines. So that, to me, means that the market's going to be flooded with essentially with placebos. So I'm trying to get a handle. I know I'm sort of rambling here, but I'm trying to get a handle on, since you've done this work, have you figured out why these people think this way? Do they truly believe that Big Pharma is hamstrung and all of these big powerful corporations are somehow hamstrung by a bunch of mean-spirited bureaucrats?
Well, I haven't done any reporting on the FDA story that you mentioned, so I can't really comment on that. But I will say that I think that this this deregulatory effort that we see in every presidential administration, I think that comes from a very real place. In the story, we quoted the owner of a local painting company who appeared at an EPA hearing, and I was at that hearing too. And what was notable about that hearing, among other things, was that there weren't a lot of people from businesses there. There were mostly advocates for environmental regulations. In this case, it was a hearing about lead. And Brian McCracken, this small businessman, he walked up to the microphone and talked about how frustrated he was with what he described as costly rules that force him to test for lead-based paint in homes before he can begin painting. And he said that each test kit for lead costs him about $2, and he might need something like 6 per room. And then if the family, doesn't hire him, those costs have to come out of his pocket. And he was legitimately very frustrated, and I talked to him after some days after the hearing, and he was genuinely very frustrated with the rule and didn't really understand why it was his responsibility to do that kind of testing. So I think that I think that the negative sentiment towards regulations is not coming from a disingenuous place. I think that some people are very frustrated with the practical implications of regulations. So I think that it's not, you know, regulations aren't on their face good or bad. I think that they're really complicated, and you know, and people do have to deal with them, whether the consequences are good or bad or both, which is usually the case. Usually they're very complicated.
Well, just in closing, Danielle Ivory, what is the next step for this this group of deregulators, these teams that have been sort of set loose, if you will, within all the government departments? Once they've done their studies or investigations, what happens?
Well, I wish they would tell us. we have been asking about what the status is of these task forces at most of these agencies. We would like to know what their next steps are, what regulations they're looking at. Some agencies have given some hints. The Department of Education has indicated that they're looking at some specific regulations, for example. So, you know, it's going to be different for each agency, I think. And our job is to just try and either get them to tell us or dig up the information some other way.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it, Danielle Ivory.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Danielle Ivory, who's a reporter at the New York Times who covers the intersection of business and government, including contracts and regulation. She is the co-author with Robert Federici, a reporter at ProPublica who covers campaign finance, and they are the co-authors of a new report at the New York Times and ProPublica, The Deep Industry Ties of Trump's Deregulation Teams. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers Graham Fitzgibbon and Clemence Penard. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.